Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's March 8th, 2016, and I'll tell you this. I would think it was St. Patrick's Day because we're full of Irish beer people, and Ann Becerra is one reason we're doing that. You got some crazy people in the room, don't we, Ann?
Yeah, I think this is the best way to kind of get ourselves hyped up for next week. Right?
Got some Irish. Who's here from the Porterhouse? We got some real Irish guys.
Yeah, Richard Stokes here. I work for Porterhouse Brewing Company.
Barry? I'm actually Barry Smith. I work for Francis Tavern downtown in New York, oldest tavern in New York.
And we're going to be talking about Irish beer in general, maybe craft beer, maybe the history of Guinness and nitrogen. And from representing Guinness, we've got some esteemed beer people here.
Hey, Jimmy. It's Heather. I'm the social media correspondent for Guinness.
What's up, Jimmy? James Stye here, brewery ambassador for Guinness.
And to help us balance it out, we got Mr. John Haw, who has written a couple articles about nitrogen, and he called it good gas at one point.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm editor of All About Beer magazine. Great to be here and great to be talking with great people about an awesome subject.
Well, hey, all right. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. Thanks to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. All right, so, and we set the stage, but, you know, what is it about Irish beer? You know, St. Patrick's is coming up.
Yeah, I think, well, at least for me, at least the Irish beers that I'm used to drinking, the craft beers or even Guinness, is that the sessionability factor is always there, you know, and it's a party. Yeah, you know, especially St. Patrick's Day. I think we have the largest St. Patrick's Day celebration in the world in New York, and people go hard and they go long, so we have to make sure that it's drinkable beer you won't get tired of, and that's what we try.
But does anyone take a stab at any history of Irish beer to set the stage? I know that they said that St. Patrick, who was actually Italian, was probably drinking Abbey-style ales when he was in Ireland. And is that true? Does anyone know anything about Irish beer history before 1759?
Well, yeah, as far as I know, Jimmy, this is Barry, it would have been similar to Europe. It would have been the monks. They would have been the intelligentsia at the time, you know. They would have been the learned. They would have been the ones that could read. And so they would have been the ones doing the brewing. But, like, Ireland got savaged with, you know, different invaders. So that's kind of, our history got lost. You know, the whole Book of Kells, all those Irish, like, religious books, the monks saved them, but I don't think they saved the brewing, you know. And that's ultimately what happened, you know.
So, I mean, I know there's something to do with England, too. And then I don't want to cause any, you know.
Yeah, there's a little bit of history there as well.
Feelings.
Well, there was, to make it quite simply, Ireland was the garden of England. So all crops and stuff like that were grown in Ireland, the priority was to go to England. So you're familiar with the potato blight, the potato famine or whatever. The whole thing was there was actually enough food to feed the Irish, but the English lords kind of took the food and sent it to England, you know. So maybe that's another reason why brewing wasn't really a priority, because the grains and everything were going abroad, you know.
So at some point for probably several hundred years before 1800, there were probably some other breweries making beer and local breweries and farmhouse breweries in Ireland.
For sure. I mean, I think ultimately Guinness kind of took over, though. They became the most successful brewery in the British Isles, and they ultimately became top dog in Ireland. I know at one stage, at its height, Guinness was responsible for employing most of the people in Dublin, you know. They reckon over 50% of the population of Dublin was employed by Guinness indirectly. So you can't realise how huge it was. If you think about Budweiser, you know, 10 years ago when they owned American beer, pretty much, that's the way it was in Ireland, except
like
a much smaller
Louis
scale.
Or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Except in Ireland, it was a much smaller scale, so it was easier to get their beer around Ireland. And
let's get John Hall. He's the editor at All About Beer. He's probably the most learned person in the room.
Well, yeah, I wish I had done some prep on Irish history and European. I thought we were talking nitro. So, but yeah, no, I'm here. I'll make up an answer if I don't know the truth to your question, Jimmy.
Have you come across any articles or talks about Irish beer history in the past?
Sure. I mean, well, there's a lot of great writers over in the UK who are covering, you know, the history, the current scene as well. You know, we've written about certainly Dublin. We've written about Belfast. We've written about, you know, the emergence of craft beer. That is to say, you know, other beers that aren't Guinness in Ireland in the last couple of years. I mean, there's a wealth of information out there. And I think, you know, that there's it's an exciting country right now, I think, for beer, and we're hearing so much more about it as a lot of the smaller breweries are making a name for themselves and getting the attention of a lot of drinkers both over there and over here.
Yeah. And then James and Heather, you guys brought also John Ulrich. I mean, is there someone on your team that wants to talk a little bit about some of the early histories of Guinness?
Sure, I can do that. No problem. Well, where do we want to begin? 1759?
Sure. Tell us the basics.
That's a good year.
Yeah, I guess. We could start at 1759. I mean, we have to look at Arthur Guinness, a 34-year-old man coming from County Kildare. He brought his inheritance to the city of Dublin, and with that, he signed a 9,000-year lease for a brewery on the banks of the River Liffey. And we are 257 years into that lease. So initially, Guinness was making both an Irish red ale and a porter as well. But in 1799, he decided to take the prescient leap to just solely concentrate on porters at the time.
So he got a deal better than, like, the Dutch bought Manhattan from the Indians for some beads?
Yeah.
Who had the better deal?
Well, I have my own opinions on that one.
You can't tell me. All right, gentlemen, we're drinking setting the stage for a little bit of Irish beer history and talks. What are we drinking?
Right now we're drinking the Plain Porter. This is Richard here. I'm from Porterhouse Brewing Company. The Plain would be our flagship beer. It's our kind of typical Irish dry stout. And I believe the main intention behind brewing it initially was to have something to compete with the likes of Guinness or Beamish or Murphy's. But to come from a small, independent, Irish-owned brewery, and, you know, the reason we started this up is to compete with the big boys and try and kind of remove the stranglehold of large kind of Diageo-backed or multinational breweries in Irish beer. It's, you know, as you can taste yourself, it's a phenomenal drop. Obviously, we believe here it's the best example of an Irish dry stout, but the, you know, our gentleman over here might disagree. It's won the gold medal in the International Brewing Awards in Burton-on-Trent in England twice.
Cool.
So we're pretty proud of that.
What do you guys think of the flavor profile on this?
It's a nice dry finish. I absolutely love this beer. I ordered it today for you know, for our St. Patrick's Day celebration. And I just wanted a quick question about Ireland in general right now. How do you think the culinary scene is affecting people's quest for craft beer? I know they were doing a big push to get chefs, you know, to come and kind of expand the culinary scene a little more. Do you think that helps you guys?
I think Barry will be better suited to answer this question. He's been back home more recently than I have. It's been a little while since I've been there, so... What do you think yourself?
Yeah, like, you know,
we're just going to have the Irish guys talk on
yeah.
it. That's it.
You have a problem with that, do you?
Good answer.
Well, I think, you know, ultimately the Celtic Tiger that most people are familiar with, you know, when the economy was doing really well, that, you know, laid the founding stones for all this kind of regeneration in Irish beer and Irish food, in that, you know, we were able to entice, you know, those big names over to Ireland. And we were able to invest in Irish beer. You know, Guinness were able to invest. Jameson, you know, went through the roof. You've got all these Irish distilleries now, you know, and Irish breweries. And it all, I think, stems from that, you know, money. And in funny enough, you know, it also stems from the fact that it all blew up, you know. A lot of people lost their jobs after the Celtic Tiger went down, and a lot of them started breweries. They started business for themselves. They were left without a job in the financial circuit, and they just had to look at, you know, rip it up and start again. And a lot of them started breweries, you know, with the money they have saved, you know. So it's definitely flying at the moment. It's a great time for, you got all these independent breweries. It's the way it should be. It's the way it is here. You got all these independent communities. They've all got their own brewery. You've all got their own style. It's great.
Everybody's looking at me, but...
No, I was just going to throw an opinion in there. I've spent a lot of time in England and Ireland, and I got to say the food and the beer is better in Ireland.
Good girl.
I hope there's no one from England listening.
John's right there.
Well, hey, So I invited you on the show, John Hall, but...
No, that's fine. I'm really enjoying this beer, by the way. I'm going to have to stock it up for the holiday next week. I choose not to go out with the masses. I figure I'll leave that up to the professionals and the amateurs that day. I just like to stay home. You guys being the professionals having to serve the amateurs.
I'll
have this at the
if
at
you
the
go
house,
to Jamie's number 43 on St. Patrick's Day, we're having a Ciders of Spain trade tasting. And then Ciders of Spain. Well, because talking about the Celtic influence, in Asturias, the northern part of Spain, it looks like Ireland. It's green, there's apples, and it's the Celtic people, and Donald Trump would be proud. They kept the Moors out of the region many years ago. I can't believe I said that on the air, but you guys all got it.
Donald Trump took credit for keeping the Moors out? Is that what you're saying?
He likes the Celtic part of it. But, you know, we're going around in circles, but I love this stuff. The Porterhouse is great meeting you guys, and you know, I love it. There's some guys making craft ciders in Ireland. You know, definitely it seems like only in the last 10 years you guys are coming out and being exported to the States. Porterhouse was the first craft Irish beer that I had only about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So when did Porterhouse get started? It was like in the late 80s or 90s?
The Porterhouse Brewing Company got started in 1996. So us, along with, I think, O'Hara started in 96 as well. We would have been, I suppose, the first wave of the modern generation of Irish craft beer. Funny enough, before that, the guys that started up the Porterhouse, Liam and Oliver back home, they had another brewery in the mid to late 80s, based in Blessington. It's a lovely little town in County Wicklow, called Hearties. And they were producing their idea of real ale. They got inspired, I believe, when they lived in London a few years previous, and you know, the whole real ale scene in England, where, you know, it's all local breweries. They wanted to do something similar. The rumor goes they were put out of business by certain larger breweries throwing money at publicans to not stock their beer. But lesson learned from that, they realised the Porterhouse, the best way to kickstart a new craft beer revolution was through the brew pub system. So if, you know, publicans are being paid to not take on their beer, just start your own pub and just feature your own beers.
You know, so I'm curious, and I don't want to go too far down a rabbit hole here, but what defines Irish craft beer? Because obviously we have a definition here in the U.S. that has changed many times over the last 25 years. Sure. There's some groups in London that have tried to define craft beer. In fact, it was the guy from Camden Town who was starting that, and then he got bought out by ABI. So I imagine that either initiative is going to die or change. You know, the definition here is built on a couple of different things. What is it in Ireland? Like, what does Irish craft mean?
Well, yeah, it's based on a couple of different things here, and I was reading about that recently. It's less easy to define in Ireland. Personally, I would say anything started within, you know, from the early 90s onwards, Irish-owned is, I think, a must-have. And Porterhouse prides itself on being we're the largest Irish-owned brewery in the country. Anything that's just not a traditional Irish brand playing off kind of traditional ideas of Irishness, it's, I think, about projecting a modern aesthetic and saying, you know, there are interesting, new, exciting things coming out of Ireland, and we're not just doing the same thing we have done for hundreds of years. I think, especially with the new wave of craft breweries, we're doing, you know, people like 8 Degrees from County Cork, they're doing very exciting stuff in non-traditional Irish styles, doing fantastic, you know, hop four beers, IPAs that can compete really with any of the best on the American market, I think, anyway.
Right, and that was my question. I was curious. I mean, I was back in Ireland in October, and I saw just a market difference.
Absolutely. There. Yeah, even in the space of the last year and a half, 2 years, it's exploding.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm just curious about the styles that are kind of just taking hold now. I mean, we all think about Ireland, we all think about the dry stout, we all think about, you know, certain.
Absolutely,
more,
yeah.
But what else has kind of taken off?
Well, as I said, more hot four beers are definitely starting to take off. I mean, as Anne said earlier, I think it took a little longer because, you know, sessionability and the ability to, you know, drink a dozen plus pints is very, very important to Irish people, you know. And yeah, you're all 6%+ beers don't lend themselves to.
Is it Heather Mick Reynolds?
In the last years, people are starting to get more kind of.
That's a good question.
Embrace the idea of sipping two beers.
What's the next beer we're drinking? Because it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's great.
We just poured the oyster stout. So this is going to be a little sweeter than your normal Irish dry stout. Nice little notes of ginger in there as well. I believe we were the first real oyster. You know, I see a few Duchess de Bourgogne doing oyster stout, I believe. But we were the
is there
first
ginger
really,
in
I think there's a small
I
trace.
Taste, do you taste the ginger? Yeah.
I'm getting like a thin mint type of thing, like a thin mint cookie kind of coming off of this.
It's also, I mean, I like to describe it has a lovely kind of brininess and minerality to it. We shuck raw Dublin Bay oysters in when we're boiling up the mash, and you can definitely taste it in there, a lovely kind of saltiness. So,
I can't believe how much John nailed it when he mouthed that to me. That just the aroma, there's something about the minty cookiness of it that I don't know where it comes from, but I love this beer.
I'm going to go pro now.
This is Heather. I got to ask, because oyster stout is one of my favorite styles to make. Whole oysters in the mash, like the guts of it all.
Yes. No? I believe so. I've never actually seen them brew it myself. The guys there, they get up pretty early. I think they start brewing around 4 in the morning. And for me to get from where I'm based in Dublin to the other side of the city,
I can't share.
I mean, I'm not that dedicated.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
So where we at now? I'll be back in a hurry. I got to go to 15th Street and cop another 40. It doesn't matter because we're drunk and we're young. A couple kids trying to have some fun. And we know these are the days we'll look back upon.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York.
Mike, can you talk, right?
For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, St. Patrick's is next week, and we just happen to have a room full of Irish beer enthusiasts and nitrogen people and some crazy stuff. Guinness and Porterhouse. Everybody. So let's jump. We did a little talk about Irish beer and Irish craft beer, what's going on with the Porterhouse guys. But, you know, one reason John Hall's here, he wrote a couple articles about nitrogen as a good beer gas. We've got some Guinness experts here. Let's talk about nitrogen. What the hell is it? You know, I mean, honestly, it's like there used to be cask ale, and all of a sudden one day there's a thing called nitrogen. I know that Guinness was not nitrogenated until a certain time. So who wants to give us a back, you know, background on nitrogen and Guinness?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have to look at the context of what was happening with Guinness products back in the day. We know the expression, the perfect pint. And that was a real thing, you know, back in, I would say, you know, the earlier part of the 20th century. You would go to a specific pub, and you would go there specifically because they were able to pour a perfect pint. And that actually took a lot of skill and a lot of salesmanship that was behind that. So we at Guinness in the 50s, we wanted to pretty much streamline and make that something that was really standardized so that every single pub could kind of serve that perfect pint. And so the managing director at the time, Mr. Hugh Beaver, he tasked a young mathematician by the name of Michael Ash to come up with a process by which we could make that perfect pint. Long story short, it was decided that nitrogen was the best means to create that really thick, frothy, velvet-like head. And that was something that was introduced in 1959 coincidentally our bicentennial. And there's a widget right there. So that was during our 200-year anniversary, and that's something we were able to launch out.
Founded, what, 1759?
Correct. Yeah.
I see it all around town on all the St. Patrick's Day posters.
Right. So, yeah. We're doing our job.
All right. So that's a little background on Guinness and the nitrogen. Then, John, you wrote an article about a couple articles about nitrogen gas.
Yeah.
You said call it good gas. Good beer gas.
Good beer gas. Yeah. That was the headline of the stories. They've run on craftbeer.com, and they've also run on allaboutbeer.com.
As opposed to me magazine. On a gassy evening.
There it is. What we've definitely seen is that a lot of the American brewers have really been embracing it. And whereas, you know, For a long time, Guinness was synonymous with nitro beers, and that was great, and they had their own towers in there. And I think that as the beer revolution has happened in the last couple of years, last 20 years in the U.S., bars are now putting in their own nitro handles that don't have to have a specific brand on it, and brewers have responded in kind. And so now brewers of all shapes and sizes, or all sizes, I should say, are making nitro beers, and some of them are stouts, some of them are porters, some of them are IPAs. These days, you know, very much in the American way, we've seen that, you know, brewers say, well, how come we're only doing stouts on nitro? Like, let's try an IPA. And they're doing it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's kind of cool to see how many bars are embracing that, and now how many small breweries and other breweries in the U.S. are offering nitro beers.
So, Anne, we're going from straight-up Irish beers to American brewers who are making beers with nitro.
Yeah, I mean, we have at Taproom 37, we have 4 nitro taps, and we're constantly rotating, and there's, you know, again, all these great new styles, and it's perfect tie-in because we have now just came in Matt Brophy, the brewmaster from Flying Dog. We're doing an event with them tomorrow, and we're going to have their Bloodline Pale Ale on nitro. So he could tell you a little bit more on how that's working, but yeah.
Hey, Matt, welcome to the show, man.
Well, thanks for having me. Nice little room here.
Yeah.
This is great. So we've experimented with different products with nitrogen pours, and some certainly seem to work better than others. I think that the Guinness thing, you know, in terms of stouts, I think that's a natural fit. Something like our Bloodline, Blood Orange Ale, actually, the difference you get between the standard carbonated product and the nitrogenated product is pretty amazing. You know, of course, you have that kind of sharp crispness, if you will, to a regular carbonated beer. And then when you introduce a nitrogen version, it really kind of rounds things out. It almost like we kid about it at the brewery a little bit. It's almost like an orange creamsicle, you know, that kind of thing. Looking back, this is great, the historical context here. I was very, very impressed. So I think what we have around us is like 80% nitrogen or something, I believe. And so I think it kind of comes when it's like that sparkler, no sparkler debate, mm-hmm. the camera kind of like gets into. But when you're doing that traditional kind of hand pump pour and you have that sparkler in there, you get a lot of that nitrogen ingression into the pint. And so I think that, yeah, a way to kind of standardize that type of perfect pour, if you will, is to introduce the nitrogen right to the product.
Sure. And there are a lot of factors that go into that. There's the flow rate, you know, there's the temperature, there's, you know, the ambient pressure as well. But I'm going to throw it back at you guys. And I'm curious, you know, and John, what do you guys think of in terms of when we're talking about nitro beers now, nitrogenated beers, are there specific styles that you guys have personally found that work better than others? When it comes to nitrogen.
Good question, James.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, just in the bar arena, I like the ones that you're typically, you know, drinking on cask. I mean, the idea that it makes it easier to drink, that it's, you know, the carbonation doesn't pop as much. You can have a couple of pints without feeling, you know, overly full. I think we tend to do better with that. The pale ales, the ambers, the light stouts. But on the same token, you know, we just have been making the rounds, the old Rasputin from North Coast on nitro, and exquisite. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a 9%+ stout. It's very rich and full-bodied, and it just lends a whole nother element to it. So I guess it's kind of like, you know, maybe it's individual beers or specific beers that work better than others, but I think the style gamut can go all over the place. I mean,
for me, for years before, like what we have now, I used to be able to get like Rogue, the Shakespeare Stout, or like Young's Double Chocolate Stout. Those are pretty much on my nitro line for a long time.
Yeah, hopped up beers really don't translate too well into nitro. And I don't care if you're a very large brewer or a very small brewer and how much hops you're putting into it. I really do. I've yet to find a true nitro IPA that really sort of delivers the same IPA experience on CO2. And so I do think that with the maltier, creamier beers that have already a thicker mouthfeel to it, or at least a stronger mouth, or at least a stronger malt bill to it, that those translate better into nitro than something with
one quick thing.
Hops.
We actually have the Guinness draft in cans in our glasses now, and I'm just asking, what's the next beer? Because I want to pour, keep the beers pouring. Okay, and I think Matt, since you walked in,
I don't know what's going on here.
We've got a nitro red ale from ourselves.
This is better than the St. Patrick's Day parade, anyway.
Yeah,
and I can't believe you started celebrating St. Patrick's Day already today.
This has been the easiest intro to St. Patrick's Day yet. All these beers, I'm like actually
I guess
done with them.
Wait, you're bringing us back to Irish beer styles. Yeah. I was reading that some of the guys in England, like Ron Pattinson, love that guy. Shut up about Barclay Perkins. Some people love him. I love them. They were saying that to them the real Irish style is the red ale.
Yeah, and that's what we're drinking now. This is the Porterhouse Red. It's a it's a nitro red. And I'm following on from what John was saying. Definitely these maltier beer styles benefit from the nitrogenation to round them out as such. It's I think the more hop forward beer is kind of controversial. There are great examples of them on nitro. For most part, I think it doesn't work. I have to say, the Flying Dog Bloodline is fantastic. It's a great example of it. So,
and we have to try that, Matt.
Indeed.
You got to get it down here to me. We're only like four seats away. There's like 20 people. <Yeah. laughs> So, James, you got to tell us, why did Guinness do a nitro IPA? That's the question I wanted to ask you for like three months.
And this is the point that I was going to get at, is I think when you're talking about a nitrogenated beer, if you're going to nitrogenate that beer has to be formulated to be nitrogenated.
Yeah.
And I guess a difference that I would say with the nitro IPA versus a lot of other IPAs that are nitrogenated is the fact that we formulated that beer specifically to be nitrogenated. So we're using five different types of hop varieties at three different stages in the brewing process, and that's purposely done in order to accentuate the characteristics.
Did you bring that beer?
I don't know. Do we bring that?
No, we did not bring that.
All right.
I mean, to that point, though, I'm not just saying there were some brewers that were making nitro IPAs and just taking the regular IPA recipe, but now they are formulating it that way. And I'll stand by what I said, that I still, all the ones that have been formulated from Guinness to Sam Adams to the rest of them, they're nice, but they just don't offer the same experience regardless of how many pounds of hops you use or how many different varietals of hops you use. I think IPA still represents itself best in CO2, and that's what our blind panels have said and a bunch of other places as well.
Yeah, and I would agree to that. The only point that I would make is when we think about IPAs, and this is kind of like the big pivot that I would put out there, is the fact that when we think IPAs, we think West Coast IPAs. We think that traditional American style IPA, and we all know that IPAs have been around for quite some time. And at least I can speak for Guinness. When we created the Nitro IPA, we came with very European sensibilities. We want to make an English style IPA, and so it's much more subdued. If one is looking for some of my personal friends out there, let's say the other half IPA, the Guinness Nitro IPA is probably not that proposition for them at that moment. But I would still argue that it's a great beer, like, for other experiences as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I see a lot of times now with the growth of the nitro beers is people putting on beers that I know for a fact were not only not formulated for nitro, but not pressurized for nitro.
Oh, yeah.
And, they make a big deal about that. Can you just speak a little bit to, I guess, bar owners, to explaining exactly why you don't do that and why it's important?
It's a great question. I'll tell you, actually, my nitro line was empty this weekend, and I asked around to a couple local brewers, and some said, I asked them if they had a stout for nitro, and they said, no, but you can still put it on. And I said, well, I've tried that. It doesn't really work that way. So kind of in line with Ann's saying.
Right. Yeah. So we have to think about nitrogenation, and when we think about that, we talk about nitrogen. Nitrogen is an inert gas, so it doesn't really want to react with anything else. The beauty of that is, specific to beer, it wants to come out of solution really quickly. And the way that we balance that in the draft system is we have to utilize a 75% nitrogen, 25% carbon dioxide proportion in order to push the liquid through the beer line, for the most part. So if that is out of whack, if a nitrogenated beer is using a traditionally carbonated
line, you know, primarily with 60% CO2, 40% nitrogen, you're going to get a lot of foam because you're having, you know, the carbon dioxide is going into solution at the same time. So you need that balance in order to have that beer pour out as intended.
So what is the thing about Guinness and the perfect pint? Maybe that's for the Irish guys and James. It's something that's, is it a myth or is it a challenge?
It's funny, so because I've worked in England and I've worked in Ireland and I've worked in America, and I know Guinness spent a lot of time educating, like I'm talking like 10, 20 years ago, educating Americans and English people how to pull a pint. And I also work in what is actually known as one of the best pints of Guinness in Dublin. And back, like you say, back before that education took place, people used to travel across the city to get a perfect pint, you know. And it's pretty simple, you know. Honestly, it's that 45 degree pour. It's presentation. It's the surge. I see a lot of our American bars now in New York. They want to present the finished ingredient, whereas Irish people, you serve the beer as it's surging, as that cascading is taking place, and you're hopping around waiting for it to stop so that you can drink your pint, and that's part of the experience. And I see in New York they actually deliver the pint already black and white, and that's wrong.
There's some other myths. Like, so I was reading before the show, like, you know, there's all these comment boards. There's all these comment boards, and someone said that the reason the pint is better in Ireland is that they serve 100% nitrogen, while in this state it's a G mix. And I know that's not true, but who wants to tell me what is the ideal mix for these type of nitrogen beers?
Right, it's exactly that. It's 75% nitrogen, 25% CO2. Yeah. And I will say for the record, the pint of Guinness that you're going to get at your local bar here in New York City is the exact same liquid that you'll be getting at the Irish pub right around the corner from St. James Gate. It's every single ounce of Guinness Original Draft and Guinness products, with the exception of the American Blonde Lager, is brewed out of St. James Gate in Dublin.
Yeah. So, and what are some other issues? Is it clean lines? Do you think some people try to push the beer through without the proper gas mix?
It's an experience issue. I mean, when you're sitting in Dublin and you're surrounded by all these awesome people, it makes that pint even more tasty. Like, the Irish people are just so amazingly.
And people have to want to drink a stout too. If they want an IPA, they're not going to want a stout. Is that bad?
Well, no, I just think people get a little scared of the color, and I think that happens all the time, you know, and I hear it so often. Oh, I'll have someone taste a Belgian-style quad that's dark. Oh, it's like Guinness. It is nothing like Guinness. I mean, you think with your eyes, you speak with your eyes almost sometimes too soon, and if you were to serve the exact same beers in, you know, the black Somm glasses that you can't see the color, I think it would be a drastic, you know,
there's
departure.
There's so much perception that people don't think about.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just the taste of the beer. It's everything else involved.
And then, Matt, we're drinking your beer right now, man. Yep. So just tell us about it, because it tastes pretty good.
Can you pass that down?
Yeah, I like it. I'm not used to having many different styles on nitro.
Just one bottle?
Yeah, sorry. We have others, though. We have other beers here.
I drank it all. Thank
only
you.
Only one of each. Yeah, so what this is, it's our Blood Orange Ale. So it's loosely based on an IPA.
Flying Dog, right?
Flying Dog. Yeah, Bloodline is the name of the beer. This started as an experiment a couple years ago. We actually add blood orange puree to the beer and blood orange peel. So it's hop forward, but not particularly bitter. So we strike a nice balance with the fruit, the malt, and some of that fruitiness and the aromatics is coming from a hop blend.
Are you based in Maryland?
Yes.
And what are you doing in New York City?
Why are you here?
Yeah,
you
just hanging out. Like, I'm just came up to see beer.
I love that.
Jimmy, you're an affable host. All right. Why are you here? What are you doing?
Having fun.
Cause. All right. Well, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions. All right. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio. This is a wild room. It's like St. Patrick's Day almost. An Irish beer and nitrogen. Huh? We got Matt Brody came all the way from Maryland to see us, man. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Cool, man. And I love that first brew you had. So what's the next brew we're going to taste of yours?
Well, we have
Flying Dog,
our Lucky SOB here, which is more along the Irish amber style. You know, when we, you guys, you know, you're all beer people. It's that balance between the malt and the hops. This, of course, is a malt forward beer. We're not looking for a lot of hops here, and we use 100% imported malted barley from Ireland, MCI, the Malting Company of Ireland. So that's kind of the signature. The signature note here.
You know, one reason we thought about doing this show, because we had Richard and Barry on not too long ago talking about Porterhouse and Francis Tavern. I thought we were going to talk about how the cask beer, there was a cask revolution, and then somehow there became nitrogen. But there hasn't really been a tie-in to that. And we talked about a little bit before the show, Barry, and who wants to jump in on why did nitrogen become a style, and, you know, what is it? Do you miss your real cask ales? I don't know.
Well,
this is like a big topic.
I've done a little bit of research on it. The Guinness guys might know better than I do. However, I've got the mic.
There's other mics, Barry.
So as far as I know, back in the day, it would have been your wooden barrel. The ultimate goal, like every innovation in the brewing scene, is to make it easier and to make it better. Nitro.
Smooth out inconsistencies.
Yeah, to smooth out those inconsistencies.
Except when you brew it the hard way?
Oh. Yeah. So ultimately, you know, back in the day, it would have been your wooden barrels, it would have been unfiltered, it would have been, you know, unpasteurized, and it was problematic, especially with the volume that Guinness were doing around the country and around the world. So I think the reason why nitrogen was born was to, you know, give that, you know, real ale experience globally, and to have it, you know, the product, you know, delivered in the way that it was intended to be delivered, you know. Like if you have a cask ale, if you pop a cask ale, we all know this, it lasts 3 or 4 days,
yeah,
and then it's gone. Sayonara. Like, so Guinness were able to prolong that life.
Here's a great beer mind, Lars Dahlhaus.
Hey guys, I'm actually the importer for Porterhouse beers, and you know, as the development goes along, technology, etc., we're actually working with a company out of England who pioneers something called beer in box, where the brewery, before filling up the kegs or the whatever, they take the carbonation or nitrogenase out of the beer and put it into a 20-liter box, a square cardboard box with a bubble inside of it, and then ship it like that, so completely flat. And then only when it arrives at the bar, and there's a box on the wall, what we call a magic box, that recarbonates or re-nitrogenates the beer, and then it's pumped up through the regular lines, etc. We trialed that at Francis Tavern a few months ago, and it turned out absolutely amazing. So that is the most freshest way to get a pint into a person's hand. The magic box just costs $1,000 per, you know, just imagine a bar putting out their money. But, you know, that's essentially where we might be going.
And the consistency and the freshness of it has to be tasted, as we believe. We're really taken aback by it. Tastes like it's straight out of the brew tanks.
So without technology, we wouldn't be drinking any of the beers we're drinking, yeah, which is true.
Yeah. And how do you guys choose which ones you want to do? And like, Matt, good question for you. It's like, you know, you make so many different styles of beer, and which is why he's here for a release of a new beer.
Right. And Maggie, you've got a question. Maggie, it was her birthday the other day.
Right.
Happy birthday, Maggie. And she was in
happy
Ireland.
Happy birthday, Maggie.
Pass your notes
that's
through,
right.
Maggie.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. But how do you choose which beers you're going to put on Nitro?
Well, for us, it's really the internal feedback. So when we try new beer on Nitro, we put it on our tasting room, and if we really like it, then we'll start producing it commercially and start sending it out.
Maggie's entering the room.
And then, Anne, so you're going to have how many lines on Nitro?
Well, tomorrow, we always have
you're
four.
At Taproom 3 or seven?
Yeah, we always have four Nitro lines. Tomorrow we're not doing all of their Nitro beers, but we are doing a couple. And then we're going to have, you know, again, as we're talking creative and creativity, we're doing a Mango Habanero IPA from Flying Dog as well to kick it off.
Fever dream.
Yeah, man. So maybe one of these days that'll be on Nitro too, and, you know, talk about from old to new.
And can I ask, like, at Taproom 307, how? So there are four. There are currently four Nitro lines. Has that always been the case?
It's not a super old bar. Since I've been there, at least, yeah.
Okay. Is there intentions of kind of increasing that?
Four is a good okay. amount. Yeah. Okay. No, I think, you know, and again, there's so many things that we have, but they rotate. You know, so many new breweries are doing something and starting to kind of experiment with that. So we can always keep four. We're not having an issue with that at all, which we would have. You know, we used to. But no, I think that's a good line. And again, it's not for everybody. So sure. I think it's the best to just offer something for everybody.
No, that was, and I called Maggie in because Maggie was, it was her birthday the other day, but it's not today. But happy birthday, Maggie. But you're in Ireland and you've been there a lot. And I know you went to college there. So tell us about what your experience with the craft cider and beer scene.
Maggie's one of our producers, in case anyone doesn't
know. We love Maggie.
Thank you, Anne. I mean, I never talk on this. But my main thing is that I remember when I was living there before I got into beer, I would drink, like, I'd have my white wine, and then I'd have, like, a bottle of the nice Smirnoff. And then, oh yeah, that was.
Smirnoff?
Oh no,
is that,
was
is that
like
some sort of fancy new kind of beer?
It was like fancy vodka distilled somewhere. But my main thing is, like, before a night out, I know, like, especially college students and stuff, like students, we would drink shit like that. And then, do you notice, like, what is the age? The new age range is, are more people trying to drink beer before they go out and not like Foster's or a bottle of Bud or something like that? Like, what do you see yourself?
When do you
like,
hook the customers?
Are you selling like more to students or more to people?
Well, I know in the Porterhouse, the original Porterhouse bar back in Dublin, students are a big crowd of it.
But are they buying your beer? Because I used to go there.
Well, they have to
because
it's pretty much only Porterhouse beers on tap, so
I
don't really have a choice.
One time, I bought a Miller there.
Okay, well, we do have the kiddie fridge there as well. You know,
nice. Miller's and your nice Smirnoff.
No, I don't think the craft beer thing has hit the younger age range just yet. I mean, I know I when I was back in Ireland recently, I had a few shifts working at the Porterhouse, and even people of my generation who are massive craft beer enthusiasts, if they're going to be going out on a night, they want to get their money's worth. I'm probably going to plumb for 8 cans of Dutch Gold or something, yeah, you know, of the similar.
I'm pretty sure
fantastic
we're the same
quality.
Generation, but
yeah,
but that's where the education cool. aspect. I mean, adults wouldn't even have this kind of beer, like you said a couple of years ago, you know. Yeah. So it's like
one
little
time
by
I
little.
Get to talk to me.
All right, Maggie.
A little by little, you know. I think
you trying to
it's your birthday.
No, it was, and I have reasonable things to say.
You're funny.
Yeah, no, I think people are buying craft beer to try at home and, you know, expand their palate in Ireland, because it is still a new concept, especially American breweries. Until recently, it was only really Sierra and Founders that had a kind of a large presence, and now we're starting to see some other American breweries trickle in. So people will buy a selection from their local off-license to take and try at home. But as far as you're saying, for a night out, I think, young Irish people still want to get a bit of mileage for their money. So
other
there.
Questions, guys. Okay, and looking at, back at history, in the 19th century, was Guinness stronger than it is now?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question because
talking about ABV or stronger. What way?
I don't know. It's just a softball question.
Well, if we talk about ABV, the thing that we also have to realize is that Guinness is not just the maker of one specific beer, right? You know, like just look at 2016. We've actually cracked open a West Indies Porter, which is it's one of our newest offerings from the Brewers Project.
6%.
At 6%. It's based off of a recipe from 1801, yeah. the same recipe, which has now become the Foreign Extra Stout. So in many ways, it's kind of the great granddaddy of that beer. Mm-hmm. And if we look at, you know, certain types of beers that were made in the 1800s by Guinness, yes, there were some that were a little bit more higher in alcohol content, you know, and that might have changed over the years, but for a multitude of different reasons. I mean, science was not as big of a deal in the brewing passions and in the industry back in the day. And so everything was really, it was much more of an art. And that was something that was kind of passed down and replicated. And so over time, that might have changed things. The other piece of it is just the social complications and things that were happening at the time. I mean, think about World War I. I mean, probably had to ration a lot of the raw materials. So that would impact the ABV on certain brands as well.
Mm-hmm.
John, anything else you want to say? We're going to wrap it up soon.
No, I think like all breweries that have been around for a long time, they change, they evolve, ownership changes, you know, new breweries get added to the mix. So, you know, I don't quite know how to answer your original question to say that, you know, what type of business is the same now than it was 50 years ago? And depending on your perspective, some people might, you know, think that there's some great things about it. Some people might think that there's not great things about it. But that's not unique to Guinness. I think that's true with any brewery that's out there that has longevity, or any brewery that has been around for, you know, or any business that has been around for a couple hundred years.
And then, Matt, what really got you guys into making beers with nitrogen at Flying Dog?
Really just experimentation and finding things that we liked. There were some comments about the technology earlier. It's amazing these days from a production standpoint, also at the dispense end, where, you know, like you can take a cask, for example, and you can serve it traditionally, you can serve it nitrogenated, and you can carbonate it in line and serve it to your customers. So I think that the customers are really looking for that experience, to be able to sample different versions of the same beer and see how it tastes, the differences are.
Ultimately, that's what we're all here for. You know, we're all here for beer, and we're all here to experience different kinds of beer. What nitrogen does, it gives it a different mouthfeel, and it actually brings a different audience into beer in some ways, especially into like the Bloodline. And we were able to, because we had the Bloodline in Francis Tavern for like 2 months, and it was a great beer to be able to introduce people. It's just like our own Red Ale. It gives a whole new audience, you know, and it brings people into beer. There's so many styles out there and so many different ways of doing things. It's exciting, you know, and it's great. And that's what we're all about, you know.
All right. And anything else you want to say?
No, that's the way to say it. I couldn't agree more. And I guess, you know, coming into to St. Patrick's Day, the idea, I have so many options to pick. I mean, my goodness, I was trying to pick a list today, and it's like there's so many things that are all quality. You know, it's a good time to be a consumer and good time to be a drinker.
Yeah.
Great. And one more guest. There's a guy, Jason, he was a listener, and he came into Jimmy's at 43 last night. He owns a restaurant in Cayman Islands. Jason, tell us about drinking foreign export stout on the beach. And that's actually a cultural thing. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Down in the West Indies, you know, we love Guinness. And I'm actually really excited to try this Guinness West Indies Porter.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to have to check out my Guinness rep and see when it's going to be down. It might.
Soon, I hope, yeah.
And what's the name of your place in the Cayman Islands?
We're Thai Orchid down on Seven Mile Beach, Grand Cayman.
And he just invited all of us before the show to come.
Oh, yeah.
What a guy. Right.
Maybe for Maggie's birthday, we can bring everybody.
There you go.
But what you told us initially, that you want to get more craft beer in the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah. If there's any distributors, exporters, anyone who has craft beer or sells craft beer, we need craft beer in the Caribbean. Come on down. We will buy it all up. We love to drink it.
All right, man. Thanks for saying hi, and thanks for checking us out. Let's go around the room. Everybody else say goodbye. Ann and Jason and Maggie. And isn't the guy back there, John Ulrich. But Matt, go around the room and just say one more time. Say your name and then who you're with. And
Matt Brophy, the brewmaster of Flying Dog Brewery. Thanks for having me, guys.
John Gibbons Hall from All About Beer Magazine.
Just James Tai, brewery ambassador for Guinness.
I'm Heather McReynolds, the social media correspondent for Guinness.
Hey, I'm Matt Barry from Francis Tavern, New York's oldest tavern.
Lars Dalhouse for Liquid Projects Importing Porterhouse.
Richard Stokes, Porterhouse Brewing Company.
Of course, we had to end with the Irish accents, but you guys, thanks for coming out to us. Thanks for our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to everybody who joined me on the show, including our producers, Justin and Maggie, and engineer David. And thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Yeah. Thank you guys.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.